Welcome to a special edition of Earth Matters Now on Community Radio KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM, and streaming live in the universe at kyrs.org. It's Friday, May 17th, 2024 at noon. I'm Laura Ackerman. Our views don't necessarily represent those of KYRS, and today we have a special guest, Nick Zentner, geologist at Central Washington University in Ellensburg, and host and writer of the PBS series Nick on the Rocks, as well as his YouTube geology channel, which has 85,000 plus subscribers. Nick is in Spokane for the Geological Society of America's Joint Cordillera and Rocky Mountain Section meeting, and he has graciously taken time out of the meeting to join us here in the KYRS studio live.
Yeah, and I'm Mike Peterson, and thank you, Nick. It's welcome to our show.
Thanks to both of you. This is a fun thing to be over here just a few blocks from where the meeting's happening.
All right, well, briefly, how did you come to end up in Central Washington, Ellensburg?
Well, that's a long story, Mike. Let's see. I'll try to make it short. It took me a long time to find geology. Many people go to college and they don't know about geology. It's typically not taught in the high schools. So when I finally discovered geology after working in Glacier Park as a college kid, I got real excited. So I went to the University of Wisconsin and then Idaho State University. And 35 years ago this month, I gave a talk at the GSA meeting in Spokane. It's the last time that the GSA meeting was here in downtown. It was in the old convention center. And that's how I got into teaching, and I've been teaching for a long time after that. So I wanted to go to a place like Central Washington University in Ellensburg, and it turned out really well.
And were you influenced by the geography, the lovely Central Washington, by any chance?
Totally, yeah. I mean, the first job after that meeting was back in Ohio, and it was a great opportunity teaching at Miami of Ohio, and my wife was teaching at the high school there, so we had good jobs. But yes, we really missed the Pacific Northwest, and so we literally quit our jobs at the end of a school year and just came out here and bet on ourselves that we would find something. So it worked out, but my parents thought we were nuts to leave those jobs for sure. So yes, there's just so much landscape-wise, geology-wise, just in Washington, let alone the Northwest. So it's a great place to be, and it has been for a long time.
And you've become sort of famous. You have a radio show called Nick on the Rocks. When did that start, and how did that come about?
Yeah, it came about because of someone at the university, an administrator who saw the potential to market the university using me. And I had been doing free public weekend lectures and field trips and things. So she's had a vision, and she thought that if Central Washington University would make these highly produced geology videos and just gave them to PBS stations, that it would be good PR for the university. And it turned out that way. So that was about 10 years ago. And then we're still at it. A new crop of people involved in making the program, but they're short episodes, but they seem to be working for a lot of different kinds of folks, not just geology people.
You were the keynote speaker Wednesday night at the meeting.
Yeah, you guys both came. That
we
was
were
nice.
Both there, and you were talking to the audience about the show, and you had several segments, and you asked for feedback mm-hmm. on the show, and it was a packed crowd. I think I was the only one that was actually taking notes. Everybody else was a geologist.
Right.
Except for me and Mike. But what kind of feedback did you get, and what did you learn from listening to that feedback?
Well, it was interesting. I've done that kind of format before. Back at my university, we would always have a little premiere event, and so we'd have fans show up, and then we would debut the 6 or 8 new episodes, and then, yeah, just like you saw, I'd show one episode and then open it up to what people wanted to ask about or comment on. But those are general fans, and that's the intended audience for this Nick on the Rocks program. It's for folks that don't know a lot of geology. But about 10 minutes into that thing you guys saw on Wednesday night, I'm like, oh God, this is different. This is actually a group of geologists. They're going to tear me apart. This is a bunch of fluffy geology with beautiful scenery. But they also got the vibe of what was going on. And so I think you heard most of the comments and questions. It was, why didn't you do that? And I think you need a map on the screen for each of those. And you maybe needed more context, but I wasn't defensive necessarily, but I just firmly suggested or reminded people that they were not the target audience. The geologists are not the target audience. And most in the room, I think, understood that I'm trying to take their work and combine it with some artistry with the videographer that we have. And it's the role and the goal of the series is to combine geology with beautiful photography and drone footage. And people seem to like it all across. Yeah.
People love it, yeah. I think. And I had to laugh at the comments about the flowers and the, you know, the fluffy geology, right, and the scenery. But I love the flower shots too, you know, and in part it gives the context of what season it is.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can take the science out of context.
Right. Well, that's, on a larger scale, that's really what geology is. I think it's what separates geology from other sciences. Geology is a science, but these places are so beautiful with the flowers and the babbling brooks and the glaciers.
And the rattlesnakes.
Throw it all in, Laura. But people have a connection to the places. So there's almost like this meeting ground. I'm coming from the world of science, but they're coming from the world of being a person who loves living in the Pacific Northwest, and everybody has favorite places.
Yeah, I saw the one on Shucks and Green Schist.
Yes.
And, of course, that caught my attention. Some beautiful shots of Mount Shuckson, which I climbed many, many decades ago.
Wow.
But I had a question about that. Yeah. You said it was metamorphic rock.
Very good. You're paying attention,
and,
Mike. Good.
Which is created under pretty high pressure, I think you said 20 miles under the ground.
Yeah.
My question is, how did it get from 20 miles under the ground to be up on a mountain?
And that's your question, and that's our question, too. It's difficult. It's difficult to explain that. It's a reality. There it is. So what are the knowns? We know that stuff was originally basalt on the ocean floor. We know that it was turned to green rock because it was 20 miles down there. Those are the knowns. And what else do we know? We know it's on frickin' Mount Shuckson, and you climbed it. But the missing piece is the mechanics and the time necessary to lift that stuff out of the ocean and get it up in those high elevations. And you can say plate tectonics, but that's not very satisfying. So there's different tectonic models to explain it, but that's a choice in a program like that. Do you try to go through four different models? No, we got like 6 minutes to go through it, you know? So you might maybe heard that comment from the geologist saying maybe the animation should have shown that green rock forming down a subduction zone and then being lifted. And he was one of the authorities on that Shucks and Green Schist. It was a good suggestion, but it's just difficult sometimes to know exactly. And that's part of what science is. There's lots of uncertainty. It's all mystery type stuff. And so you can kind of lean into the fact that we don't have all the answers. You can't do it too often or people will stop listening to you. But it's important to remind folks that lots of these things are unsolved mysteries, and that's why it's fun.
I think it's the way you approach it in the videos.
Thank
and,
you.
You know, how you ask about it. And it's like, mm-hmm. it's like, it sets it up for, like, tune in, because later someone's going to figure this out.
Yes.
And I think especially in the inland Northwest and in the, you know, central part of the state, mm-hmm. someone did figure it out.
Yes.
As you well know.
Yes.
And I mean, he, you know, we're talking about J. Harlan Bretz, and he had a little help from Joseph Pardee as well. And since he did figure that out, and now he's celebrated as a, you know, as a geologist, but mm-hmm. he certainly wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I think that's gonna happen more and more.
Well, I hope it is. That's, you know, I'm over 60 years old now, so I'm kind of always thinking about the future and hoping to inspire a bunch of new people doing this sort of work. But yeah, even an example like Brett's, you're right. He was battling people who, through most of his life, didn't agree with his idea that there was a lot of water happening quickly, an actual flood of water, which was an outrageous thought 100 years ago. And so he eventually convinced everyone by them all coming out to places like Soap Lake, where you grew up, and the Grand Coulee and Moses Coulee and over here by Spokane. So that Cheney, all those lakes. So that sold his idea. But what I've been doing this last winter has been looking at his main story 100 years ago, which was really not the Missoula floods. It was an ice sheet over the city of Spokane and having water coming directly out from the ice sheet at Spokane. And that was Canadian water, was what he was saying. So that part has been lost. People don't talk about that anymore. And so that's what I've been, that's what we're going to do this weekend. We have these experts who in Ice Age floods, and we're going to spend the next 2 days going around to these sites that Brett's was carefully saying, look, this is, the glacier was here at Spokane. And if you've ever seen a map of the Ice Age or the Ice Age floods, the ice is never over Spokane. But Brett's was saying the ice was south of Spokane, and that ice was sitting right there at Cheney. And here's this water being released right from the water, from the ice front. So even with that, it seems like a nice, tidy Brett story. And he was victorious and given a big award. And that's all true. But the big part of his story is kind of lost to time.
So, are you going to be telling that in future videos? Or is there going to be some filming this weekend?
There will be some filming, I think. I'm going to have the camera stuff ready. Well, it's... These are the heavy hitters in geology, and I don't want to get in the way and start screwing up the vibe, you know, and shut the discussion down since I have a camera out there. So I'll have to test the waters tomorrow morning, but hopefully, yeah, I can. And it's been a culmination of what I've been doing the last 2 years, really, and been interviewing most of those people on YouTube. So
yeah, and I have a question about that later in the show.
Sure.
I think you want to ask something.
Well, I just wanted to follow up on this. Glacier over Spokane.
Ah, your ears perked up a little bit. Yeah.
Will you be able to find evidence of that, that there was ice over the top of Spokane? Because we'd always heard before as the Clark Fork or around Missoula that
yes.
had this ice dam, then it broke. Mm-hmm. And some people, I don't know if everyone believes it happened multiple times. But what evidence do you think he had that it was, Brett's had that it was literally covering in south of Spokane?
Great question. First comment is, Brett's had evidence of two different ice sheets. So two completely different times. Wow. So even that is new to most people. Maybe your listeners right now go, oh yeah, I know the Missoula floods. I know all that stuff. It's only told in with story of the ice happening one time, and there's an ice dam over by Sandpoint, Idaho, and it's blocking the water in Clark Fork River Valley in western Montana, and then you break through the ice dam in northern Idaho, and that water comes screaming over downtown Spokane. And yes, many think that it happened dozens of times. But Brett's ice sheet covering Spokane, he says, was an earlier time. And he couldn't, back in 1920s, couldn't figure out when that was, but he thought it was for sure an older time. So that's the first comment. So if we realize, okay, there's two different ice sheets at two different times, then we are leaning into Brett's idea of what he called a Spokane ice sheet, producing the Spokane flood, as he called it. He didn't call it the Missoula floods. And so, yes, this weekend we're going to go to some of these sites. There's a place called Pantops, which used to be a train station pretty close to downtown here. I couldn't tell you exactly where it is. It's, I think now, it's up on South Hill, basically. And he had some, there was a quarry there, and there were a bunch of big boulders and other rocks. And he said, this is a moraine. This is a place where there was ice coming right to south of Spokane. There was another spot down by Cheney against a couple of those steptoes. And there's, again, gravels and boulders that he was interpreting. And the stones were real weathered and kind of old-looking. He kept mapping those things. And you're like, well, why haven't we heard about that? Well, the Missoula floods narrative took over. And again, that's that younger time. Yeah. And so people have known in the last 50 years about these gravel pits and other places around Spokane, but they had just assumed it was all gravels that were from the Missoula floods. Water, in other words, coming through. But again, we're back to Brett's idea that maybe there's some of these older ice margin deposits, of, as we call them, that survived the Missoula floods and are telling an older story. But it's a radically different story.
Yeah.
If you get into that older stuff, we're not talking about water coming from Montana. It's coming down across the Canadian border, and then we're getting into why is there all this water coming down from Canada? And his idea was that there was some sort of volcanic eruption in southern British Columbia under the ice sheet that must have heated up the ice dramatically. And we have a word for that, an Icelandic word, Jökulhlaup, where that's happening on the island of Iceland today, volcanic eruptions under ice, and you have a big outburst flood. Bretz was on that 100 years ago, and he spent a whole summer of 1926 up in southern British Columbia looking for those lavas that would have produced the water. And he found some lavas and got very excited. We have all of his field notebooks that we've made public this past winter. But then he had a big meeting in Washington, D.C. in January of 1927, and he met with all the USGS experts, and that's who I'm with this weekend, the new generation of USGS experts. But he met with the USGS experts, and he gave a two-hour presentation on his Spokane flood and his Spokane ice sheet. And he sat down after 2 hours, and each of the USGS geologists stood up one by one and said how it was impossible to have an outrageous flood of water. And from that moment on, he stopped talking about that Spokane ice sheet and Spokane flood, and he leaned into the Missoula flood thing. So,
wow, that is fascinating. This is a great story.
Oh, thanks, man. I just think it's so fun to just combine human history. And we had a lot of the YouTube viewers doing their own digging on Spokane in the 1920s and old photos. And Thomas Large taught at Lewis and Clark High School here in town, and he played a role. There was a lot of fun discoveries in the last 12 months or so.
And what does USGS say about this, the Spokane floods now? Or are you just not going to tell us?
Oh, no.
Do we have to wait?
We don't have to wait. So all these guys I've had on camera. So, from starting in the pandemic, I taught myself how to use YouTube with this cell phone. And so I started broadcasting just because I was trapped at home and was... I didn't like having an empty calendar. I don't know how you guys did in spring of 2020. But that has continued to grow, the YouTube thing, as you mentioned, Laura. And so now I can do it from my office, and I can interview these USGS geologists live, and they are all willing to come on. And some of them pretty much echo what the USGS guy said 100 years ago as far as, well, no, that's not true. They all agree. They're all enthusiasts of an outrageous flood. So they all celebrate Bretz. But they don't celebrate this Spokane flood thing and this Spokane ice sheet thing. And so they're all gracious enough to go out in the next couple of days. And I'm not going to be teaching. I'm just going to let them argue among themselves. And we have a Canadian geologist who is a big proponent of the Spokane flood, essentially, this water coming over the border. So... hopefully it will be an uplifting, energetic debate.
Yeah, wow.
And not just people talking past each other.
Well, we'll have to look forward to that.
Yeah.
And last night I was at the section meeting, and they had the video with Dr. John Major, who's the volcanologist.
Yeah.
And he was just talking about what came out of the eruption of Mount St. Helens in May 18th, 1980. And the first thing he said was, like, there was just this amazing interest in volcanoes worldwide after it blew up. And I think I see that in just your Nick on the Rock series and with your YouTube. All of a sudden, geology is really cool.
Well, thank you. I think there is a bit of an impact, not nearly of that scale. He's totally right. I got into geology not because of Mount St. Helens, but yes, I became a geology major in 1983, and I was taking my geology classes with like 65 people in each class, and that's unheard of today. So there was a huge boom in interest in geology. So yeah, what I'm doing is not of that scale, but it is nice to see that there are some young people who are inspired by some of the things that I've been doing. And there's a little bump more than a little bump at my university, but I think other universities as well. And that's important because universities are struggling after the pandemic.
Right. So when you were a college student,
mm-hmm.
did you do a project and present a poster and take it to a section meeting and talk to complete strangers and as well as other geologists about your project?
I did not. And you're my age, Laura, and it was a different world
then.
It
was in college. I didn't do that in college either.
No, where did you go to school?
I went to Western.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It was not done by anybody that I'm aware of, where you were an undergraduate and you had a senior project and you traveled to a GSA meeting. So, yeah, it wasn't until I got into graduate school that I entered that world. So, yeah, these kids that you saw, they're literally, you know, sometimes they do running start and they're like showing up on a college campus with 2 years complete already. I'm like, good Lord, you're 18 years old and you're a junior already? So, yeah, they're young, but they are polished. They are inspiring. I know that you were inspired by some of those posters that you saw the other night.
I talked to a lot of them, and then I talked to four of the students on. They came over to do a
good
radio show, and four of them showed up. And I was impressed, too, by how much women are entering mm-hmm. the field. But mm-hmm. it was also very noticeable that almost everybody at this conference was white.
Yep.
And that there's a real lack of diversity in geology and probably other sciences as well.
We're moving in the right direction, but yes, there are some reminders that there's ways to go, and especially the Ice Age floods. It's usually a bunch of old white guys mm-hmm. that all dressed about the same, and they have silver hair, and they got the beard and the khakis and everything. Yeah, it's
the plaid shirt. Chad always says, yes.
Exactly.
I wore one sort of plaid shirt today just to feel like I fit in with you and everyone.
So, yeah, there's things are changing. It's inspiring. Yeah, selfishly, I love being around young people and just staying fresh. And so, what we can continue to improve for sure in that area.
Well, let's ask about digging into your family.
Sure.
You have some kids. What do they think of Dad on the rocks?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, we have three boys. And my wife teaches science at the Ellensburg High School just down the street from us. So our three boys grew up not really loving the geology stuff. They're all outdoor enthusiasts, but the geology thing's already kind of been done. So I was pretty good about keeping my mouth shut about most of that stuff. So they kind of like that people see their last name and they wonder if they're related to me. I gave a talk in downtown Portland last Friday and two of my boys showed up and that was kind of a nice surprise.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. But they're all school teachers. They're all doing their thing. They're all they've got their lives together. They're in Western Washington and Western Oregon. So yeah.
They don't teach geology.
Nobody teaches geology. Nope. They teach some, one's a physics teacher and another one is a social science and American history type stuff. But
so they're teaching guys. Science and stuff though. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's Ellensburg was a really wonderful place to raise a family. Mm-hmm. We knew we wanted to live in a college town that was relatively small and it continues to be a really fine place. But I have good memories when I ever come over. I'm just in a good mood when I come over to Spokane. We always do some Hoop Fest and Bloom's Day. I've got my first teaching job after giving a talk here. So I love coming over here for a bunch of reasons.
KYRS did Bloom's Day. We do a live broadcast of Bloom's Day.
Oh, you do?
From Broadway Avenue. But I didn't see you. I was there. I
wasn't there this year, no.
Okay.
Yeah, when our kids were, you know, younger and middle school age, we were definitely coming over every year. But it's been a while since I've been to Bloom's Day. But we'll be here for Hoop Fest, all of us, next month.
Are you going to be on a team?
Nope, I'm too old for that. My knees are gone. But I always try to find John Stockton walking around. I think that's kind of cool. So I always look up the Stockton last name, and he's usually coaching a grandkid by now.
Yeah, I think he does have grandkids.
Yeah.
And he's not that much older than we are. Maybe he might even be younger.
I think he's exactly our age, to be honest. I'm kind of been obsessive about him over the years. I like how he conducts himself. He's a huge celebrity, but he seems to just keep a low profile around here, as far as I can tell.
Well, Nick, I know you're interested in history.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about the history of geology. I mean, that's certainly part of it, but yeah, just a lot of history. And history is one of the many intersections that geology seems to have with a yeah, whole lot of other disciplines.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
Well, sure. Yeah. Kind of back to this. I've been doing these winter projects, let's call it, where I do 26 episodes on a theme. And I call it an alphabet series. So I did exotic terrains A to Z, and I did crazy Eocene A to Z, and those were pretty hardcore geology things. So I was just teaching myself new things, but there were live viewers on YouTube that were part of this community, and they were quite loyal. But this past winter, I did the Ice Age floods A to Z, and for some reason, I don't think it was a dramatic decision, but at some point I realized I could really get some help. And if I ask the viewers for help with some of this history stuff, I'm going to find way more than I would have on my own. Because I did know that Brett's was in a certain place in a certain time. And I only knew basic things about where he was each summer. This guy, J. Harlan Brett's, was a University of Chicago geology professor, and he came out every summer from 1922 to 1930. And he always had some Chicago students with him. And so I was getting incredible amounts of information from the viewers, newspaper clippings to add all sorts of detail. Like the Spokane paper would interview him every summer, and he would talk about his findings. Old photos. The most profound was at some point, some of the viewers went to the University of Chicago and said, can we see the field notebooks of J. Harlan Brett's on file? And they would let them in, and they would snap a few photos with their phone, and then they would send them to me. And then one thing led to another, and all of the field notebooks that have been collecting dust for the last 100 years were created. Somebody made them into PDF files. They scanned them, and they gave them to me. And I put them on my website, and that was right before this project started in mid-November. And then I got an email from the University of Chicago Library saying, we're a little uncomfortable that you're taking all this stuff from our library and putting it on your public website, just called nickzentner.com. That's kind of a violation. Even though these are old notes, it's copywritten. And they're all typed beautifully, and nobody had seen those. So I went to the viewers and I said, I could use a little more help. Can somebody figure out how I can connect with one of the descendants, the living descendants of J. Harlan Brett's? Because this Chicago library says, we're not going to let you post these unless you get permission from the family. So again, people are on Ancestry.com and all sorts of stuff. And before I knew it, I had email addresses. So I made contact with Brett's great-grandson on the East Coast, and he was very supportive, and he wrote a letter to the University of Chicago's library. And so now I have all those notes on, and we were using the notes all the time. So that's geology combined with history right there that would normally just be under lock and key.
And so, a fan base.
Yes.
As well.
Yes. So that was right. The family was excited because they're proud of their grandpa or their great grandpa. Mm-hmm. To see all that rich detail. And yes, he was in Odessa that day, and he went over to Ephrata that day, and then he went up to Crab Creek. That really comes to life. And so some of the viewers were making custom maps to show where Brett's was every day. And then another guy, Glenn, who lives in Liberty Lake, had a history with Google Earth and professionally, and he's retired. So he was placing Brett's field locations on Google Maps. And so now Google Earth as well. And so those files were also available online, so people can like zoom around on Google Earth and see all these places that Brett's was describing. So the thing kind of had a life of its own. But that was a departure from what I normally do, where I'm just sharing some geology that I've learned. I was learning more from the audience members by the time we got to February than ever before.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to a special edition of Earth Matters Now on Community Radio KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm Laura Ackerman, along with Mike Peterson, and we have a very special guest today, Nick Zentner of Central Washington University. You probably know him as Nick on the Rocks. He is here for a conference, the Geological Society of America conference, and he was gracious enough to come over and talk to us for an hour.
Yeah, I'm so intrigued with this history of a century ago, and mm-hmm. then it makes me also start wondering, did Brett's talk with any of the indigenous people here at that time, and did he get some stories there or some ideas of where to go because of that?
That's an interesting angle, Mike, and I've been trying to do a little bit of that, but that's not an easy set of relationships to set up. And if he's showing up for just a few weeks every August or something like that, then so the short answer is no, he didn't go in that direction. And maybe that was a radical approach 100 years ago. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But he did have some connections in the area. Thomas Large was a very influential high school teacher at Lewis and Clark High School. And there was a science faculty, Alonzo Troth and Joseph McMacken, but especially Thomas Large. And Large was kind of a cheerleader for Brett's. He invited Brett's to come to Spokane because he knew he had expertise in other areas with ice deposits. Large had connections with the Automobile Club out of Spokane and the Chamber of Commerce and the newspapers. And so there was a lot of publicity about Brett's because Large was kind of setting up public talks. And again, we have the newspaper clippings for a bunch of these public appearances. And Large also invited Joseph Pardee from the USGS to come.
You might have to explain to listeners who he was.
Sure. Well, Joseph Pardee is now remembered as a very important USGS geologist who initially published on Glacial Lake Missoula in 1910 and did a lot of mapping up in northern Washington on the Colville Indian Reservation, mineral deposits. Pardee made a lot of money over the course of his career. He was based out of Montana. But he was known as in the first couple decades of the 20th century, Joseph Pardee was well known. And so Pardee came. So here's another big discovery from the viewers and everything else. Boy, how did this even go? Let's see if I can remember. Some of the USGS geologists started watching this program, and they got inspired enough to try to find Pardee's notes. And some of those notes were found because he was a USGS employee. There's a special way to keep those USGS notes. So Jim O'Connor from USGS in Portland made a special request to get Pardee's field notes in February. And he started reading those notes, which nobody had seen. And Pardee was here even before Thomas Large invited him to Spokane, which was new. But better than that, Pardee was talking about Ice Age floods.
Wow.
2 years before Brett's even showed up. So here we go. The famous story about Brett's and the Missoula floods and nobody believed him. Well, we're now finding some evidence that Pardee maybe 2 years earlier was on to this and yet didn't feel comfortable publishing it with the USGS or something. And who knows? Maybe we'll never find a connection between Pardee and Brett's as far as letters or something. But, yeah, that's intrigue that just keeps coming and the story keeps changing. And, you know, kind of ruffling some feathers here. Like everybody's been publishing and telling stories about Brett's and the Missoula floods their whole career. And now I'm coming in and kind of shaking things up a little bit with a different approach. And some are excited by it and some are like, this guy needs to shut up, all right? We got our story. We don't want it to change. So, yeah, it's a weird set of reactions to kind of some fun discoveries.
It'd be interesting to see if there was letters to telling Pardee to back off from his superiors.
Exactly. So the letters between Brett's and Large. Okay, well, that's another. You got me going now, Mike.
Keep going. This is good.
I mentioned that the Brett's archives was in the University of Chicago, and there's still a bunch there that I did not get scanned, a bunch of letters and things. So there could be more done there. But Thomas Large, the Lewis and Clark High School teacher here in Spokane, his papers went to Eugene, Oregon, reasons I don't understand, but they were in Eugene. So the viewers at some point around Christmas time said, hey, you can also get Thomas Large's papers from the University of Oregon. So I made a special little short video over the Christmas break, and I looked into the camera and I said, does anybody live down in Eugene, Oregon? There's probably good parking during Christmas break. You can get right on campus and get in there and see if you can get access to some of those Large papers and letters. And so six different viewers who didn't know each other all showed up on the same day.
Wow.
And they introduced each other, and then they just got to work and split up all these things. And so there were letters between Large and Brett's, very personal stuff, talking about the discoveries in that. But you're right, Mike. That's the angle. We don't have that between Pardee and Brett's. That would be, I think, the ultimate thing there, to the back off thing, or I don't know. I don't want to ruin the legacy of J. Harlan Brett's, but if there's letters where Pardee's like, what are you doing, man? I gave you all my notebooks, and now you're publishing all this stuff three years later? I don't know. That's kind of delicate. But yes, to have Pardee figure out and visit all these sites that Brett's made famous a few years later, it's kind of an interesting twist.
Well, what I've always read is that Pardee, he provided the origin of the flood.
Yes.
To Brett's theory that there was water. I mean, that was a really big question. So where is all this water coming from?
Good.
And Pardee apparently knew that.
It's never sat well with some of us, but that is the story.
Right.
So Pardee publishes that Glacial Lake Missoula existed in 1910. Brett's wasn't even a geology student at the University of Chicago in 1910. So it was a known thing. Then Brett's does all this work, and you're right, Laura, after 10 years of publishing, everybody's saying, where's the water coming from? He's like, I don't know. I've got these channels. It might come from British Columbia, but I have no way to prove it. But he didn't mention Glacial Lake. Why wouldn't he mention Glacial Lake Missoula as the source with many of those papers? He knew it existed. For sure knew about it because Pardee was not the first to actually publicly write on Glacial Lake Missoula. T.C. Chamberlain and Roland Salisbury documented it in the 1880s, and they were the advisors at Chicago for Brett's. So anyway, so
fascinating.
Yeah. Wow. So the story that you're totally correct on, Laura, is that Pardee retires from the USGS in the early 1940s, and he immediately, as soon as he's retired, publishes of these giant current ripples on the floor of Glacial Lake Missoula, proving that there was a traumatic draining of the water. And he apparently couldn't publish on that while he was working for the USGS. I don't know why, but that's the way the story goes. So there's this weird disconnect. Brett's was done. He'd given up on the channeled scab lands. He couldn't convince people there was a big flood at all. And then more than a decade later, here's finally this paper that Pardee wrote saying, here's where the water is and here's where the... So the timing of all that doesn't quite work. And Pardee, by the way, was in that room in 1927 when he was ambushed by all these experts, and Pardee was very quiet sitting there in the back of the room, but he was there.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's, you know, most people say it should be a movie. Somebody should make
a movie out of it. But it's so interesting. If you look at it from the perspective of the 1920s, Central Washington was fairly remote.
Remote.
You know, you didn't jump in a car and drive up the Grand Coulee that easily. Brett's was on foot. Anybody else? A lot of people were on foot.
Yes.
Grand Coulee Dam hadn't been built.
Yes.
It might not even have been thought of. It might have, but there was no Columbia Basin Federal Irrigation Project.
Correct.
And there were no drones. There was no aerial flight.
Right.
And so Brett's did all of this work on the ground, and he's probably put a few miles in walking. And then now, so we fast forward. I mean, even in the 1970s, I don't think Brett's was really recognized for what he did until the late 70s, because he died in 81, I think. He was almost 100, I think, when he died.
Oh, you're on top of your stuff here.
And
good.
So I, when I was, I graduated high school in 1980, and so I was a teenager, mm-hmm. and there was a radio station in Moses Lake, and Sagebrush land was so cheap that the radio station would buy like 10 acres, 5 acres, 10 acres. And they would say, okay, the fifth caller wins 10 acres. I mean, it had so little value.
Oh, wow.
People just thought of it as, well, it's just good for farming.
Right.
It's, there's really nothing else here. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, there's some odd geology, but you know, it's really not worth that much. Yeah. And I mean, even Hanford being shoved where it was in part, I think was because of, it was just so remote.
Yes.
And now we have geologists. Here's, you know, you have much greater access to it. You've spent a lot more time on the landscape than Brett's ever did. Mm-hmm. You have drones. We have aerial photography.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Grand Coulee, I have to admit, and but I'm biased, is my, really is one of my favorite places. And, you know, because you have ice floods, you have water, and then you have these phenomenal coulees,
yes.
or canyons as they call. But so as a geologist, and you talked about this a little earlier, but
right.
I want you to expand on this. What are you leaning into as a theory now that you have, and you have a lot of science mm-hmm. in there, and there's a lot more geologists.
Mm-hmm.
What are you leaning into more as a geologist in terms of how you think this really, you know, what is a more complete story?
Well, it is a story, first of all, and I view myself as a storyteller, mm-hmm. really, whether it's the video stuff on PBS or just the YouTube stuff or the lectures that I do. So, yeah, I've been on this story for the last couple of years, and so I'm not doing any research. I just feel like I'm someone taking all this raw material and trying to package it a certain way. And I'm intrigued. I continue to be intrigued with Brett's ice sheet that was over Spokane. The same ice sheet was in the head of Grand Coulee. It was right there at Steamboat Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just releasing all this water directly from the Spokane ice sheet. So I had a slogan that developed over the course of the winter, older, bigger, younger, smaller. So the idea was two different generations of floods, as Brett was talking about. And the way he was writing about it, the Missoula floods were the younger, smaller set of ideas, but there was this bigger ice sheet with bigger floods that did most of the carving of the coulees, like Grand Coulee. So even that was just kind of a gift, where when I drive from your hometown, Soap Lake, up to Dry Falls and then up to Steamboat Rock, I'm looking at that majestic canyon with the potholes and all the crazy erosional features, and I'm thinking, okay, Brett's was saying that's the older story, and it happened maybe thousands of years, maybe even tens of thousands of years before the water came from Montana to bring in the slack water sediments, as we call them, and the big erratics and the boulders and other things like that. So to separate, to take the Missoula flood story, which is usually told in just a few thousand years, and yeah, there were a lot of floods, but to say that everything's happening in just a few thousand years, some of us are now starting to see that this is over the course of more than a million years with different flooding events. So it's a new way to view that. And so that's what these USGS geologists are going to be discussing this weekend.
Wow. And to think that there might have been some massive volcanic eruption under an ice sheet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It seems like there could be evidence that you'd find from that.
There could be. He really had one field season up there, Mike, and he was excited by a few basaltic lava fields. And he was like, not usually full of exclamation points in his notebooks, but he was that summer. He thought he really had something there. And then again, he got shut down in January, so he never went back. I mean, we can now figure out the age of those lavas.
Yeah.
We couldn't do that before. So I honestly, sitting here right now, don't know if somebody in BC has worked out exactly the age of some of those lavas. Were they during the ice sheet time? I know there are tuyas, which are like cinder cone volcanoes that have kind of a cone shape, but they have a flat top on them, a tuya, T-U-Y-A. And that's a landform that is eruption under ice.
Ah. Huh.
So
if they start finding those.
And they have.
Oh, and they have. Hmm. Wow.
But we're in BC now, so it doesn't the conventional people say it can be a younger ice sheet where it's not producing a bunch of flood water. It's just an eruption under ice. So you can see how this goes back and forth like crazy.
Well, I'm fascinated by the fact you're considering that you're putting all these different stories together. I call that author. So how's your book coming?
that is a common
Well,
common
you could play
question.
J. Harlan Brez in the movie.
Yeah, there you go.
Usually a book and then the movie, right?
Okay, right. Yeah.
Yeah, the book thing keeps coming up, and I really have no interest in that. It doesn't sound like fun to me, and I tried to do it once or twice. People were very encouraging, but it's just not my talent. So, but there is material there for something, and yeah, I'll just continue with my own style. But,
geological historian, perhaps.
Yeah, it's an evolving role, but I think I'm just kind of a connector, I guess, between different people and different topics, and I like that part, and so I'm kind of a matchmaker.
Well, I think that's important in science, to be a matchmaker. And I think it's certainly a lot easier. I mean, you know, you get six people in Oregon over Christmas, like finding out stuff for you.
Yeah,
that's impressive, and it's important as well. And kudos to all of your fans who really care about this story. And who see the value in 6 minutes of Nick on the rocks. I mean, because in kind of the modern world, we don't have perhaps the attention span that we used to have. Mm-hmm. And maybe you see that with your kids or with your students.
Right.
Yeah, and so do I.
Yeah.
And so I think that it accomplishes a lot. Your Nick on the rocks has accomplished a lot in 6 minutes. And then if you want to go deeper, there's some of the YouTube videos are a lot farther, and we don't have that much time left.
Sure.
But what are some of your places you really like to visit in Central Washington, mm-hmm. or anywhere in Eastern Washington, and why?
Well, there's a long list. Yes.
Not surprising.
So, yeah, let me give you some examples. I love Moses Cooley. Moses Cooley is not known to many people, but it's an important site. Ties right into what we were just talking about. That was an important place for Brett's as well. So, yes, we've made video programs on Moses Cooley. I've done lectures on – I've met people out of the blue and just did what I call a pop-up geology, where I just say I'm going to be at this place in a certain day and time, and we'll have a little video camera, and we'll just have a little party with whoever wants to be on the side of the road.
Do you know much about Moses the man?
No.
That's a very interesting story.
Is it?
And his tribe visited – they were – they gave the name of Soap Lake the original name of Smokayam, which is roughly healing waters.
Okay.
And they would spend a lot of time at the lake. And he was a big guy, like six foot two, probably about, that's probably how tall you are, 6'2", 6'3", mm-hmm. and didn't speak English. And he was called Half Sun on the Columbia.
Oh, wow.
So there's Robert Ruby and John Brown have done a lot of work on them.
Okay.
And, but I, you know, it would be really interesting just to include some of that if you do some other Moses Cooley videos, if you have a chance to.
Well, thank you. Yes. Something kind of unrelated, but it's maybe a good example. Brett was talking about ice at Wenatchee, Washington. Hmm. And nobody today in geology is talking about ice at Wenatchee. Hmm. And so I just kind of left it there, whatever. And then I do have a couple of Native American associates who trust me, and we go out and make videos on occasion.
Good.
And an elder in the Wenatchee Piscosa tribe, Randy Lewis is his name. He's a really good guy, and he's very knowledgeable. And I was just out with him a couple weeks ago, and I said, "Where are we going today, Randy?" Because I had my little iPhone ready to film a little bit, some mics. He said, "Well, let's go up on Badger Mountain. Let's overlook Wenatchee." And so we started filming. And he starts talking about a Native American story about ice, a wall of ice at Wenatchee.
Mm-hmm.
And a giant creature slapping the tail at where Lake Wenatchee is, and a big flood.
So
that kind of intersection of these resources that are there that are usually kind of in their own little silos, if you can develop the right community and trust, then there's an example of how you can take these different worlds. And I'm not the person to write it up or do anything academic about it, but it's just...
But you're, again, the matchmaker.
It's fun. It's fun to make those connections. Yeah. So it is just as much about people as it is the geology, I think. And that's what that PBS series is doing as well.
So Moses Cooley was the first thing you mentioned on your list.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Drumheller Channel. Yeah, I've been thinking about the Ice Age floods a lot, so I'm tending to go there. Drumheller Channel, south of O'Sullivan Dam, kind of by Othello, Washington. It's a wildlife refuge now. That's a special place. There's beautiful columns of rock there. More in central Washington? Well, sure. Earlier winters, I was into older rocks, and so Mount Stewart and the granite of Mount Stewart and the Ingalls Drainage there by Leavenworth, that's a special place. Up by Chelan is a favorite place, the Pateros boulders and the Chelan migmatite, which is a complicated zebra stripey looking rock. Pretty long list. And it's all within a couple hours drive of Ellensburg. So to bring it all full circle, if I was still in Ohio, I could come out like Brett's did, I guess, 4 weeks every summer and try to pick something, but I'm a homebody. I get up early, have breakfast, head out the door, have a little iPhone, and I can make an easy little video with so many different kinds of rocks and landscapes just within it. I can be home by dinner time.
Yeah, I was talking to a couple of the students at the section meeting, mm-hmm. and they were doing field work in Alaska.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they lived in South Dakota, and it's right. like, there's not that much known about Alaska because it's, again, the remoteness, it's yes. really tough to do field work there. Yes. And that's really impressive. And I think part of that certainly of your success is just like you say, you get up, you have breakfast, you get in your car, you go see what you see in your home for dinner.
It's a good life. It's a good life. It's full of satisfaction and academic curiosity. And some of us have figured out how to just keep the life of a student going our whole lives and don't really feel old when you do that. So, yeah, it's, you know, I continue to work at Central Washington University and our geology department continues to grow, especially because of some of this visibility and mm-hmm. a couple of young professors I was talking about the other night. So we are growing, and just in our department and our university and other universities are shrinking. Due to the realities of a post-pandemic life. So we're hoping just to keep bucking the trend with what's going on.
Well, and the cost of college.
Yeah.
It's radically different than when we all went to college.
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, how would viewer or listeners find out more about geology in general, but also about, I think you mentioned you have a website or Facebook page or something?
Yeah, the two places, I have really one website where I put all of my stuff in one place because that was a common question for years. How do I find this and that and this and that? So I made nickzentner.com. That's it. Nickzentner.com. So all of the video programs are housed in that location. There's an audio podcast. There's lectures. There's different formats. And then there's the YouTube channel that's different. It's also just my name, Nick Zentner. But the YouTube channel is all tied right into my webpage. So if people just go to nickzentner.com, it's all right there. And there's hundreds of hours to lull yourself to sleep. I've heard that my voice is soothing and helps people drift off, which is just fine.
It'll give people something to do when the next pandemic comes along.
That's right. There you go. They may not be conscious right now. They've been listening to my voice for the last hour. But
no, we could talk to you for a few more hours easily. Unfortunately, we don't have the time.
I understand.
Yeah, this has been stunning because for me, you live in the center of some of the most amazing geology on the planet.
Yes, Mike.
And you're kind of putting it all together. I can't wait to hear about your next trip to British Columbia to find the secret volcano.
Thank you, Mike.
Are you ever going to retire?
All of my friends are retiring these days, and I talk to every one of them, and I'm like, what are you thinking? What are you going to do? And like, I can't imagine what I would do with my time, really, honestly. So
Keep it up.
If I retire officially for whatever reason, the university's failing or something, then I will have all these other outlets to keep me going. But, yeah.
There's a lot to see still.
There is. Yeah. So it's – and I hope you guys continue with what you're doing here. This is an amazing – community radio station you've
Well, and
here.
Good luck to Ellensburg starting their community station.
Yeah.
I was really excited about that.
I don't know where they are in their process, but they have big plans.
Well, Nick Zentner, your geology professor, really, at Central Washington University, and Nick on the Rocks, NickZentner.com, Nick the YouTube guy.
Too much,
but you know, but not enough, I think, for some people.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We really, really appreciate you coming over, taking time out of your busy schedule and being on our show. It's been such a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. I've enjoyed chatting with both of you.
This has been great. And to have the Geologic Society of America happening in Spokane right now, that's amazing. And you've been a great part of it.
Yeah.
So thank you.
We got press passes thanks to Chad Pritchard. Okay. So thanks for that, Chad. So you've been listening to a special edition of Earth Matters Now with Nick Zentner on Community Radio, KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.